Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, the Beehive Swarms, the Box Office Edition. It's Wednesday, December 6th, 2023. On today's show, Renaissance, the concert film produced, starring, and everything else, Queen, Diva, Beyonce. But she's so much more than a diva. This is so much more than a concert movie. And anyway, it won the weekend, and we'll discuss. We're joined by Slate's own Nadira Goff for that segment. And then the director Todd Haynes returns with May December, the story of the extended afterlife of a wildly inappropriate and age-discrepant relationship that resulted in a marriage and children. It stars Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore. And finally, how much Grinch is too much Grinch? We will discuss a new Grinch book, a posthumous Grinch sequel, with Slate's own Dan Coyce. But joining me first is Julia Turner of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, face to face.
Hey, Steve. Good to see you face to face.
All right, let's make a show. Beyonce, she is no stranger to making documentaries about herself. She's, after all, a diva. And a diva is her own muse, QED. This is her third, though, in about a decade. But Renaissance, a film by Beyonce, feels somehow definitive in a way that its predecessors maybe did not. It is, to begin with, a three-hour concert film-ish. Roughly three-hour concert film, but it's really much, much more. It's also a backstage arena tour procedural, a verite peekaboo behind the scaffolding and into her life and creative processes. It's something of a personal diary. We'll get into whether that's real or not real. Anyway, she unsurprisingly sums up the movie best, I think. Being a Black woman, everything is a fight, she says. Eventually, they realize this bitch will not give up. All right, what we have for a clip is a piece of the trailer. Let's have a listen.
Time is my biggest obstacle. It's impossible to not realize how fast it's going when you are looking through the eyes of your children. I think about all of my heroes and all that they endured. I know that all of my struggle and sacrifice is opening the door for the next. They are the new beginning.
I wanna house you and make it take my name. I'm gonna spouse you and make it touch a ring. I'm gonna take
I have nothing to prove to anyone at this point.
Baby, can I take you?
We are creating our own world.
Okay, well, for the segment, we're joined by Slate's culture writer, Nadira Goff, and very, very good and close friend of this program. Nadira, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk about this movie.
I'm really excited to talk about it with you. Where to even begin, Nadira? I'm going to let you pick. This is a Beyonce smorgasbord. There's a lot to choose from. I mean, as someone who has studied and in some ways exalted while critically in her career and persona, where did this bring you? You maybe hadn't been before with her and her work.
Yeah, I think that this movie is really surprising in a lot of ways in terms of a lot of things, but specifically the way that Beyonce is presenting herself and her craft and her life. And so for the majority of her career, she's really been someone who has prided herself on this idea of perfection. You know, she strives for perfection. She achieves perfection. All of her shows sort of run, like, as she says in the movie, a well-oiled machine. And in this film, she's breaking down that idea of perfection. Now, mind you, it's still her creation. It's still this idea of imperfection in her specific lens. But it's interesting to me that the tone and theme of this film is, I want to actually show you the process. I want to actually show you what life is like when things go wrong. I want to actually show you what happens when I mess up, or when, you know, a family member messes up, or when something just goes awry. And I don't want you to come away thinking that I'm perfect or that this is just effortless. I want you to come away thinking that this was hard work, that it involved a lot of people, and that I am actually a very flawed human being who's just trying my best. Again, some of the ways that she depicts that can be a little bit, you know, hagiographic, a little bit eye-rolly. But for the most part, I think it's a really interesting shift in how she's presenting herself and her idea as what Beyoncé is as a, you know, persona or an icon.
Right. I mean, there's kind of like the Jumbotron self that a pop star operating at this scale has to perfect. There's an illusion, at least, of intimacy that they also have to perfect. And there's a natural tendency to cultish hagiography when someone does master life at that kind of global pleasing scale. But that can be alienating, so you also have to come off as human. Dana, I'm interested in this as a work of cinema. An easy contrast is with the Taylor Swift movie. We don't have to belabor it, but this is, given the jump cuts that you can talk about maybe a little bit, this is clearly a work of cinema. It's not just a filmed concert.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that specific question, because that's exactly how I wanted to address it. As I was making notes, I almost wanted to acknowledge and set aside Beyoncé as a performer and her self-presentation as one thing to talk about, which Nadira just opened with and we'll talk about more. And then this nearly 3 hour long thing that's showing in movie theaters, right? Which I think of the films that she's made, it's the first one that's had that kind of theatrical projection as a work of cinema. And I have to say that while I found her a jaw-dropping performer, and I was really glad to have seen the movie just to get some sense of what it would be like to be at a Beyoncé concert, I don't think this totally works as a piece of cinema. And it felt nearly 3 hours long to me for reasons that had nothing to do with the concert clips that were all spellbinding, that had more to do with aesthetic choices that were made. Okay, the editing, since you mentioned it. Something that this movie does very deliberately that's very different from a movie like the Taylor Swift documentary or Stop Making Sense, right, the classic Talking Heads concert doc that we just discussed, is that it doesn't try to create the illusion that you're at one concert, right? In fact, it deliberately plays with that idea by cutting from, describe it this way, within a single performance, right, you'll suddenly see after one cut, wait, Beyoncé's in a different costume and all her background dancers are in different costumes. This has to be a different night. And then it'll go back to the original one, then go to some other one. And part of the effect of that is to show you the mind-bending array of incredible couture costumes that she has on, which I hope Julia will touch on later. But another thing that it does is tell you this is not the same concert. This is a movie showing off its editing precision, right? So that somehow she and her background dancers are all in the exact same position so that this cut seems seamless, even though they're dressed differently. So it has to be a different night. And I guess that's kind of a virtuosic tour de force of editing. But to me, it also underlined the mechanistic angle of this show, right? I mean, you would have to, and many reviews of the movie have observed this, you would have to choreograph something so precisely to be sure that, you know, the angles would work in the cut. And to me, that almost, it served to undercut the kind of spontaneity and authenticity that Beyoncé is trying to telegraph, right? And so that to me, there's this cognitive dissonance in this movie where she's working so hard to show you, look, I'm showing you all my flaws, right? The song Flaws and All is one of the first songs in the movie. But that lack of virtuosity is being shown to you with incredible virtuosity. So I never kind of felt that I was really glimpsing anything more real than you would glimpse if you were at the show itself.
Interesting. And this gives me a great double pivot to Julia, because it's both, Julia, it reminds me of something you once said about her that has stayed with me ever since, which is that if nothing else blows you away about this performer, she always hits her mark. To the degree that every performance would be seamlessly the same if that's what she so choose. And so I'd love to hear you talk about the relationship between this person's cyborg-like perfectionism, which some of the costumes really get at. There's a kind of weird Donna Haraway, I am a hybrid creature, I am both human and digital and metallic all at once, that's weirdly seductive but also alienating, mixed in with all of the couture. I'm just curious to hear you talk about both the mark hitting and the costumes.
Well, I'll try to come at that from both angles, Steve. I mean, first, I loved this movie. I wept during this movie because I felt so moved by her brilliance and by her growth. So I like fell for it completely that this was a more mature sharing of herself and like comfort with beginning to reveal the person behind all that technique. I mean, I remember on this show, we discussed the documentary she made for, I think, HBO 10 years ago that was like so, it was sort of the dawn of famous people producing their own documentaries. And I remember us being like, well, this trend sucks. Like, this is the most boring possible documentary you could see. Yeah, I've learned nothing. And I, so on an emotional level, I felt like deep catharsis. I felt inspired. I felt like I wanted to be a better person. I like, it really, really got to my viscera in a way that I've like experienced with Beyoncé on the dance floor, obviously, but like, I don't know that I've experienced watching her as a kind of cultural figure in the same way. At the same time, I also had a kind of intellectual response to it, which is about just the hyper-evolution of celebrity. And we had this thought about the Beckham doc too. Like, we're 10 years into celebrities producing their own documentaries, and they've gotten smarter about it, and they know that if I make something completely boring and sanitized that doesn't answer and address the obvious questions that we have about them, we will smell it and hate it and move on. On a pure mechanical level, Dana, when I first walked into the theater and saw those quick changes between the costumes, I was like, what the hell is this? I'm so confused. And then it pulled me in, and the kind of, I don't know, like riotous precision, is that a thing that can be? It seemed like what it was to me. And it was, I'm so glad I got to see all those costumes. They were fucking incredible. And so I loved the kind of just sheer inventiveness that was on display. And I just went for it, hook, line, and sinker.
I loved it too. I was completely floored by it. I've been immune to this performer's charisma, charm, talents, while knowing they're there. They don't affect me at all. This altered completely within about 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes. First of all, she begins, Nadir, she opens with two numbers standing perfectly still at a microphone. I mean, she's extraordinarily dressed and an extraordinary presence. She doesn't move to be captivating, but it just emphasizes her status as a singer for two full songs. I mean, maybe the second one goes into a larger break and then there's movement, but effectively she begins with her voice foregrounded, and unlike certain other performers who will go unnamed, I think she actually has the voice to carry a three-hour concert as a concert. And then the cinematics of it, the stagecraft of it, the extent to which she showed you that this is not one city traveling around the globe en masse, complete with nurses, seamstresses, and every other kind of specialized labor there is. It's actually, in a sense, three, that there are two entirely separate sets that are at the following two cities that she's going to go to, setting up in order to make the timing of the tour work. Just the sheer gigantism of it, and the kind of the Steve Jobs-like X factor that it takes to have a central personality driving the whole thing, aka her, I thought was very powerful and very moving. I'm like Julia, I'm very skeptical of celebrities getting good at the illusion of intimacy, and that stops me short a little bit, but by and large I was won over. I cannot describe how completely I was not bored for 1 second in the course of the 3 hours.
I'm so glad to hear that. And I just want to say one thing. I was at the show. I went to the Renaissance tour this summer. And I think for me, with a concert film, my favorite concert film of all time is Stop Making Sense. The most important thing to me is if you can convey the energy of what it's like to be in that room through a screen, which is really hard to do. And I have to say, I've never been to a show that felt so euphoric, where every single person there, I mean, even the people running the concession stands, were smiling and happy to be there and enjoying everybody else's specialty costumes that they had planned months to make, and were just reveling in this beauty of this special moment that an artist could give us. And I know that that sounds super cheesy, but it was real. It was really, really real. Like, it is. It makes me emotional to think about it, to be honest. And I feel like this movie did such a good job of bringing you there and portraying that, and then also sort of incorporating the history of the queer ballroom culture and all of the things that sort of built this sound of this Renaissance album and then this show and this tour. And I just find that to be so revelatory in a way that's even a step up from Beyoncé's previous concert film, Homecoming, which I think is amazing. It's great. I'm pretty sure that I have a blurb about it in Slate's Black Film Canon. But to me, this is even, you know, one step above that in terms of just showcasing that pure, really free energy that everyone in the room had that she facilitated for everyone at those shows on those nights. Mm.
I'm going to be an outlier and say that I think that my favorite film that she's produced so far is Homecoming. For me, Homecoming telegraphed that feeling of what it would have been like to be at that Coachella set. Maybe more than this. Of course, I wasn't at the concert, but this felt a little bit more like, it felt like an artifact. I mean, it wanted to make itself feel like an artifact of an entire tour. And so while it was sort of a stunning object to behold on the screen, I didn't feel as much like I was being caught up in the energy of a live show. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like I'm the outlier on being utterly, utterly blown away by this movie, but I still think people should go see it, whether or not they consider themselves Beyoncé fans, as Steve, you just demonstrated.
All right. The movie is Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé. It's in theaters. It's worth checking out. To put it mildly, Nadira Goff, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always just a total pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
All right, before we go any further, this is typically where we discuss business. Dana, what do we have?
Steve, we've got two items of business this week. First of all, we are getting ready right now for our annual listener call-in episode. This is the end-of-year tradition where we take call-ins from listeners that we have a voicemail number to receive. They can be about culture or they can be about anything at all. Ask us our favorite Greek tragedy. I don't know. Ask us our skincare routine. Whatever you can think of, we will try to answer it as long as it's not so personal that we would be exposing our inner lives on mic. Well, I guess we kind of do that willy-nilly every week.
Also, you've just given them an invitation to, you know, probe.
Some incredibly disturbing personal
question.
What's
Dana hiding?
Anyway, if you want to ask us one of these terrifyingly personal questions, give us a call and leave a message at 260-337-8260. That's 260, Fest 260. I feel like a drive time DJ. Or you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. And who knows, we might pick your question to answer at our call-in episode, which tapes later this month. We want to put an end date on these questions so that they don't start rolling in when it's too late for us to choose among them and use them. So let's say a week from the day that this podcast is dropping, which is to say Wednesday, December 13th. Get us your questions by that date, and we'll be able to go over them and have time to sift through them and pick some to answer on the show. Our second item of business is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to answer a listener question from a listener named Tim, who wanted to know how we decide what to read next when we're reading for pleasure. I like this question. I'm very curious to hear what Julie and Steve have to say about it, because I feel like my own reading choices follow some kind of internal logic that is very specific to me, and I'm sure that's the same with you guys. If you're a Slate Plus member, you'll hear that segment at the end of this show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up at slate.com/culture plus. What does it mean to be a Slate Plus member? Well, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus segments on many, many Slate podcasts, including ours, and best of all, you get unlimited access to all of the writing and all of the podcasting on slate.com. You'll never hit a paywall when you belong to Slate Plus, and you'll be supporting our work and helping the magazine stay afloat. So please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus.
All right. Well, the film director Todd Haynes has been making courageously weird, bewitching films ever since Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, went on to make Safe, Far From Heaven, Carol, so many great movies. If he makes it, I want to see it. The formula is very simple. He returns with May December, the story about two women. One, played by Natalie Portman, is a famous actress who travels to Savannah to research her role in an upcoming film. The object of her close study in Georgia is Grace, played by Julianne Moore, who 23 years earlier seduced a seventh grade boy, then, while serving a prison term for statutory rape, gave birth to his baby, and then, on release, married him. Only superficially is the movie based on the Mary Kay Letourneau story. The film is really a study of love, subordination, denial, and even Hollywood cynicism as they come to mingle in the grayest of imaginable gray areas. It also stars Charles Melton as the now grown-up man-boy who's the father of her children and husband. In the clip, you're going to hear the voices of Natalie Portman as Elizabeth, Julianne Moore as Grace, Portman's characters working hard in the scene to try to get to know Grace better. Let's listen.
When they sent me the script, I just thought, now here is a woman with a lot more to her than I remember from the tabloids and our cultural memory.
I don't really think about all that.
You don't ever dwell on the past?
I have my plate pretty full. Mm.
I mean, I know that for me, personally, the past weighs on me. You know, decisions I've made or relationships.
So you just sit there and you think about your history and your behavior.
Sometimes.
Dana, let me start with you. I'm curious what your history is with Haynes as a filmmaker. I imagine you're an admirer, and what you made of this one.
I mean, just briefly on Haynes the filmmaker. Yeah, I'm a total fangirl. And yeah. I think I feel with him like I got on the ground floor, because I was lucky enough in college when Superstar came out, but it never really came out, right?
It was very hard to find. It was Samizdat.
Well, it's because of, you know, of IP, whatever legal reasons. Superstar, his first film, which was a sort of a short film, it was in between a short and a feature, was this crazy telling of the Karen Carpenter story with Barbie dolls. And because Mattel had never approved it, and I think it also had music stuff that hadn't been approved, it was an underground movie that you could only see in Haynes's presence, right? If it was being shown in an educational institution or something, for years and years and years. And we had a great college film society that happened to get a hold of Todd Haynes and Superstar. And so I got to see it when it really was an underground object. And he was this, you know, brand new, like handsome, smart, exciting filmmaker. And so ever since then, I've had this feeling like whatever he does, same as you, whatever he does, I want to see it. I haven't loved every movie equally, but I so love that he's always changing and experimenting. You know, the Velvet Underground documentary that he made a few years ago. Just gorgeous, right?
Just a great film.
And the first thing I would say about May December, which I will say is not in my top niche of Todd Haynes movies, but is, you know, a sort of thrillingly weird watch, is that it has one of the strangest tones of any movie that I've seen in several years. And so it's actually very pleasing to me that it's kind of hitting with audiences. I mean, critics liked it at festivals, you know, that it, as it opened over the past year. But when I saw it at the New York Film Festival, I thought, I cannot imagine that this is going to land very well with your average audience member, because it's so impossible to know how to respond to it emotionally, right? It's about this really queasy subject matter, but it opens almost as a comedy. You know, it's sort of a dark comedy. It has these elements of melodrama mixed into it. it's really hard to figure out who to identify with. I mean, both of these two women, Natalie Portman's character and Julianne Moore's, are pretty awful even from the beginning and reveal themselves to be more and more awful as the movie goes on. Late in the movie, we sort of settle on Charles Melton's character, Joe, as not the hero of the movie exactly, because he's so passive and so acted upon by everyone else, but, you know, someone that you feel enormous sympathy for and fear for. There's a moment, when, not to spoil anything, but there's a moment that you think something physically dangerous is going to happen to Joe, to Charles Melton's character. And to me, that was the moment that I realized, wait, I am invested in this movie, because if something happened to him, it would be absolutely terrible. Anyway, I want to hear, Julia, how you responded to the tonal and emotional tenor of the movie. I know that Haynes has not liked the fact that people are calling it camp. You know, a lot of reviews mm-hmm. have identified the movie as campy, and he has kind of responded to that in a somewhat prickly way, saying that he didn't intend it as camp, which made me relieved that I didn't use that word in my review. But I can see why it's being used, because it is really hard to tell whether we're supposed to laugh, cry, shudder, run out of the room screaming, or what, upon watching May December.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about this film. And I should disclose here that I know some folks involved in making the film. So you should take my comments here with a bit of a grain of salt. But I really, really loved it. I'm not the biggest fan of Todd Haynes's, and not that I'm not a fan. I'm an admirer who never watches his films and feels like, ooh, that one really twanged my internal guitar string, you know? Like, I mostly have thought about Carol. I would like all of those coats. And in this one, I just thought it was so nervy and strange, and I liked that the cinematography was looser and lighter. It didn't have that, like, lacquered jewel box feeling of Far From Heaven or Carol. And what was interesting about the tone to me, and the reason why camp feels like the wrong word, is that I think it's quite sincerely emotionally curious about how humans operate and the stories and lies that they tell themselves to justify their behavior. And I don't think of camp as a mode that's about the sincere exploration of human emotion. You know, despite the fact that these women are both operating in the public eye, one through her awful behavior that resulted reasonably in a national scandal, and the other through just being a famous, you know, TV actress who's turning heads when she walks through rooms, they're both trying to kind of find the underlying human reality in justifying their behaviors. And I found that to be really resonant and interesting. And then I found the film to be so compelling in exploring that kind of pedestrian self-justification in the confines of these very extreme situations. So it moved me.
I think this may be, it's up there with my favorite movies of the year. And one of my, I mean, there's so many to choose from, but one of my favorite Todd Haynes movies. I think Melton is amazing in the film as this man boy who has never been fully allowed to develop as a human being. And the way he as an actor physicalizes it is so subtle and yet so totally expressive. And it comes home to you. I mean, he's a physically large man who's kind of tightened and shrunken into himself because of the low level manipulations and torments of being married to this woman, who's always going to be the senior partner in the relationship. But then there's an extraordinary moment where he's driving his children, who's had with her, I think just the two daughters, who are in the back seat. And his body is suddenly expansive and open and free because he's just out of her orbit, and he's a good father. I mean, it's such a complex movie with so much economy in some sense. I mean, you learn what you need to know about him in that moment. To me, it's fundamentally a movie centered around two women in a mirror in some sense. There are at least two, to me, central scenes in the film where Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore are looking into a mirror, but the mirror is itself the lens of the camera. And the kind of peculiar subterranean romance that they've developed with one another as they're each using the other in ways that's highly complex but deeply seductive. Especially Portman, right? Because this movie is in many ways a study of an actress, Janet Malcolming, a person, right? So Malcolm is famous. Janet Malcolm, the journalist, is famous for saying every journalist who's not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what's going on knows what he does is morally indefensible. He's a kind of confidence man, preying upon people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust, and betraying them without remorse. The movie's both a study in the kind of damage this woman who seduced a boy has wrought not only on him but on her children, right, which comes out also very economically, but is deeply sinister and heartbreaking. But it's also the story of this Portman character, Janet Malcolming, in the most cynical, manipulative, cold-hearted way, this woman's vanity, in order to ultimately betray her, to portray her in a way that won't honor what this narcissist thinks her own story is. The layers of complication conveyed with very little dialogue and exposition. I just think it's a brilliant movie.
I wonder, in relation to that, what you both thought of Natalie Portman's performance. There's a great piece in Slate by Sam Adams about how this is the ideal role for Natalie Portman because she's such a technical actress, which she is, I think, often critiqued for being somebody who can sort of nail every note, but doesn't seem to connect warmly with other actors. That's perfect for this character, right? She's literally playing a kind of chilly technical actress. Do you see Sam's point that this is kind of Natalie Portman at her apex?
Absolutely. And then what's so weird about it is that you begin the movie thinking, what kind of a performance is she giving? There's something a little brittle and dissociative about this person. And then you realize that's a mask. And then you see beyond the mask. And then the film becomes this dual portrait of two hearts of darkness in a way. Each equally compelling. I mean, they're both such extraordinary actresses. I mean, you know, Julianne Moore, an exquisitely classically beautiful woman whose face can become this forbidding rictus at the drop of a hat, something that she's been totally unreluctant, willing, game to do throughout her career, especially in the Haynes movies, like Safe being one of the great examples. Enormous vulnerability there. And then Natalie Portman, who suffered the awful fate of Elizabeth Taylor, is being construed as the most beautiful woman in the world before she was a woman, who's somehow taken that and, like Taylor, turned it into the career of an actress of serious depth and honesty. I thought this was both of them at the top of their game. And then in relation to one another, it was just a joy to watch from beginning to end.
Yeah, it really, watching them together is incredible. I also just want to shout out the screenplay by Sammy Birch. I think it's her first produced feature, and I think so much of the richness of performance is allowed by just the depth and intelligence of the screenplay. Like, what an interesting movie. You know, if you said, hey, a newcomer screenwriter wants to make a movie about Mary Kay Letourneau, is this the movie you would imagine? Like,
yeah, run,
no.
Run.
And it's so original and so well done. So I'm excited to see what's next from Sammy Birch as well.
It's a great movie. It's on Netflix. You really ought to watch it and shoot us an email. Really curious to know what people think about it. May, December, Todd Haynes film. All right, let's move on. Okay, well, The Grinch was published in 1957. So Dan Coyce tells us in his piece about a new Grinch book that was 8 months after The Cat in the Hat, as he says. It was at that point unclear what kind of a living Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, was going to make. This one sold into the millions. It's huge. It was, of course, turned into an absolutely classic Christmas time cartoon. And the IP has been mined repeatedly to within an inch of its life, several live-action films, animated films. Well, now there's a sequel that looks and feels like an original Dr. Seuss book. It's not. It's new. It's written by Alistair Haim, illustrated by Aristides Ruiz. It's called Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Lost Christmas! Here to talk about it is Dan Coyce, writer at Slate and author of the novel Vintage Contemporaries. Dan, welcome back to the show.
So glad to be here.
So where to begin? I mean, what was it like just reading this book?
Well, it's, you know, when you read a sequel to a book that you yourself have read to your kids 10 trillion times, you read it with that eye. You read it with, oh, what would the response be if I broke this one out to my once small children and tried to get them to go to sleep one night the way that I did many, many years ago with How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And, you know, I regret to inform that this book, the new book, the sequel, can't match that feeling of total astonishment with which small children greet Dr. Seuss's original genius idea of a monster coming down from a fucking mountaintop and stealing Christmas out of your house.
Right. It's like making the insight involved, like the eureka insight involved in making a creature out of whole cloth, non-human creature out of whole cloth, that is the spirit of anti-Christmas, so in excess of the prior holder of that title, Scrooge. Right. I mean, it's just, it is eternal. And then having, you know, having it be unbelievably witty, clever, somehow getting at the essence of Christmas from a completely unexpected angle. And then to have Boris Karloff voice it in a definitive Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss-approved cartoon.
And they're hanging their stockings, he snarled with a sneer. Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Just to talk a little bit more about the genius of the first book.
Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, came up with it the Christmas before 1957, he says, or at least according to his biography. And he came up with it based on his own grinchiness. He says he looked in the mirror the day after Christmas. He saw this scowling face, totally irritated by the whole holiday, and thought, oh, that's a book. That's Dr. Seuss right there. He worked in advertising for years. He was responsible for a number of unbelievably successful ad campaigns in the 30s and 40s, long before he was a successful children's author. And yet he despised the commercialization of Christmas. It drove him nuts. And so he says he wrote How the Grinch Stole Christmas as a way to try to, reinstill in himself the actual joy of the season. What gives the book its power, though, I think, is the way that parents recognize that grinchiness when they're reading it to their kids. We recognize the parts of us that are driven insane by how acquisitive and greedy Christmas makes our children. There's that, you know, that two-page spread in the original book of all the Who girls and boys playing with their toys and making insane noise down in Whoville. And it's like a Hieronymus Bosch nightmare, that spread. And so then to have that reading experience with your kids and to see their pure and honest horror at the idea of someone doing this thing to truly the greatest holiday mankind ever invented, is pretty bracing as a parent. That's where I think the book's elemental power comes from. And that's why it was a gigantic instant hit that completely transformed his life. You know, a couple of years before those two books were published, The Grinch and The Cat in the Hat, he was writing his editor at, you know, Random House being like, do you think maybe I'll make $5,000 this year? Because we really need money. And then after this, every book he'd ever written was selling in the scores of thousands every single year.
So, first of all, I love your analysis of the original Grinch. He's totally right. You're right. Yes. That's why the book is good. I mean, not that, like, he's right, and then when he gets his comeuppance, that's writer. But it's like, if the holiday is all about getting and getting, it sucks. And then if you remember that the whole point of presents is that you're trying to connect with the humans you love and kind of encapsulate the empathy and generosity that you want to extend towards them all year long in a like physical manifestation on one day, you're like, oh, right. You know, like my older children are at the age where they've just discovered that giving gifts is fun and not just getting them. And it's very sweet. And that is part of what the whole thing is about. So hard endorsed to that. I guess I will say that in general, when beloved children's books and children's book authors get reanimated from the dead for sequels, I hate it generally.
You become a Grinch.
I'm grinchier about that than about the consumerification of Christmas, because it's awful. And it suggests that they think the kids can't tell, which they sometimes can't, and that the parents stuck reading this shit can't tell, which we definitely fucking can. And I would just like you to rank in order of cruddiness Zombie Seuss, who seems decently represented here. There's also like a whole series of kind of Cat in the Hat, I think they're like maybe TV explanatory lesson-giving TV shows turned into the books, where the Cat in the Hat is no longer a maniacal force of chaos like Loki in animated form, and instead is just like a kind of friendly teacher who tells you in deeply un-Seuss-worthy rhyme about like protozoas or whatever. So those are horrible. But even worse than those are Zombie Curious George, where you can really tell in like the just heft of the work what is an original Curious George and what is a pedantic, simpering, idiotic follow-up. So I would extend to the group broadly, like, why there's just like a lack of seriousness extended to the picture book reader, I will say, now that I'm back in that chair, that drives me bananas. Like, why does this book need to exist? This Grinch follow-up. It's a perfect book. There's plenty of Seuss. I'm sure the Seuss estate is making plenty of money. Like, leave the Grinch alone.
Yeah, I totally hear you, Julia. I feel like I don't even consider the Babar books written by Laurent de Brunhoff, the son of the original author Jean de Brunhoff, to be real. I don't even want to talk about the ones that are like Babar Does Yoga or something like that, that are just written by some random team of consultants. But Dan, I wanted to ask you to that effect, to talk about the poetry, the writing in this new, well, for one thing, just the story, the basic story, because since Julia's talking about moralizing, I think this new story is more of a kind of morality play and a less convincing one than the first book. So I would like you to just outline what the story of this book is and talk a little bit about the writing by Alistair Haim, which is written, it looks to me like it's written in Seussian prosody, right? It scans like a Seuss, but it doesn't sound like a Seuss. So can you talk about that, the story and the way it's told?
Sure. So that, you know, Alistair Haim had a big problem, which is that not only is How the Grinch Stole Christmas a more or less perfect book, it also has a perfect ending, and an ending that eliminates from possibility all future conflict between the Grinch and the Who's of Whoville. But so you have this conundrum, which is, all right, the Grinch now loves Christmas. His heart has grown whatever, seven sizes, and now he's just like a good guy. So how do you make drama out of that? And the way the book handles that is by having the Grinch be determined this year, it is now the year after the year that he stole and then discovered the meaning of Christmas, this year he's going to prove to all the Whos that no one loves Christmas more than he. So he enters the Whoville Christmas tree decorating contest, a contest so important it is front page news, the A1 story in the Whoville Times. And he enters the contest, he decorates his tree, he brings it down with the help of his dog, Max, and then he loses the contest to Cindy Lou Who, you know, little tot Cindy Lou, who was no more than two last year. And he pitches a fit. He's a sore loser. He gets really angry that he lost. He storms back up to his mountain, his heart shrinking in his chest. And then Cindy Lou tells him, "Mr. Grinch, I put ornaments from everyone in Whoville on this tree who loves Christmas, but there's one ornament I haven't put on yet, and it's yours. Can you please come back?" And then his heart grows again, and he goes down, and he accepts that Cindy Lou, a child, is allowed to win the Christmas tree decorating contest, and then he loves Christmas again. And the problem, you know, there's a lot of problems with this plot. The most basic one is that there's, like, nothing elementally evil and amazing about it. It's just that he doesn't like losing, which I'll grant you is like very recognizable to the children to whom you might be reading this book, but it doesn't have any actual power. It's so recognizable that it doesn't have that like alien, impossible monster nightmare force of the original book. The poetry is like fine, and it's meant to ape Seuss to the extent that it even recreates certain moments in the original book. It, you know, the moment in the original when the Grinch has his wonderful, awful idea is now recreated in this book as the Grinch getting an awfully crafty idea to make a beautiful Christmas tree. And so I think it's perfectly pleasant to read aloud, but the thing it doesn't deliver is what is so great about the original book, which is the sense in your audience that something impossible is happening. You know, that's not there anymore. And that's what I think you really miss.
All right. Well, Dan, you are an EFOP. You're just an exceedingly exceptional friend of this program. It's always great to talk to you. Your piece is up on Slate now. It's Dr. Seuss's How the Grinch Lost Christmas in Defense of the Grinch by Dan Coyce. Dan, thanks for coming back on the show. Just so fun.
A Merry Christmas to all.
All right. Now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Diana, what do you have?
Steve, I'm going to endorse. This is sort of a two-part endorsement, but they go together like wine and cheese. So I'm going to endorse the Pogues album, If I Should Fall, From Grace With God, in honor of the passing of Shane McGowan,
incredible songwriter
and frontman for that band. And along with it, this is the cheese to go with that wine, is Amanda Petrusic from The New Yorker wrote a really, really beautiful little tribute to Shane McGowan that was one of many things, including his music, that made me cry last week, knowing that he had left us at the age of 65. He is too big of a figure with too big of a career to get into it all now. And I think we've even talked about the Pogues before on the show, maybe, at least in an endorsement segment here or there.
Yeah.
And the reason I wanted to choose one of his early albums is just because something that really struck me on reading that he had died at 65 is that he was so young when he wrote these songs that have this incredible world wisdom and this sense of this like hard-won truth to them. And it's a little bit like Tom Waits, where it's sort of like this person is such an old soul. You can't believe that they wrote the songs that they wrote when he was, I guess, probably in his early 30s when that album came out, and was always someone who seemed, I never saw them play live, but every story of the Pogues playing live was sort of people couldn't believe that Shane McGowan, who was an alcoholic and I think at one point a drug addict and just like someone who took such horrible, horrible care of his physical self, they couldn't believe that he had made it to the stage, you know, for another show.
Yeah.
And so really for him making it to 65 was quite an incredible feat. Anyway, I mean, what I'm really recommending is that people just go on their own deep dive and listen to the Pogues in whatever way they want to. But that seems like a good album to break into listening to them with, although it's not their first.
Okay. Favorite Pogue song. Pick one.
Oh, my gosh. I'll say Rainy Night in Soho. That's a Pogue song. Seriously? Right. I mean, was that going to be your
favorite? It's that or Lullaby of London, probably. I mean, those both are, but Rainy Night in Soho is the one that's just over and over again, inexhaustibly.
I took shelter from a shower, and I stepped into your arms on a rainy night in Soho. The wind was whistling all its charm.
And that's one that's not even on the album I just mentioned. That is on their first album.
Yeah, that's
Rum Sodomy and the Lash.
Yeah. Dana, thank you so much for doing that. That's really wonderful to hear you talk about Shane McGowan. Rest in peace. Julia, what do you have?
I've got a two-part endorsement based off of our segment about the Grinch and wavering towards children's books. The first is I want to endorse the Little Blue Truck books, which are written by Alice Schertl and were originated in their illustration by Jill McElmurray, who was a listener to this show until her death in 2017. And her estate gave permission to continue the Little Blue Truck books with an illustrator working in her style. And her name is still on the front of them with a note about the illustration style. And I have the illustration style is perceptibly different for sure, but somehow that seemed like a respectful extension of the work she'd created to me. And I just wanted to, I always appreciated knowing that she was a listener when I was reading those books to my older kids and thinking of her again, reading them to my youngest one. So just wanted to shout that out. And then I also have to name my favorite Seuss, which is a lesser known Seuss, which is Hunches and Bunches. I may have endorsed it before because I know we've talked about Seuss on this show, but the thing I love about Theodore Geisel's work it's Beyoncé-like in its excellence because the illustrations are incredible and vivid and of their own brilliance. The things he is doing with meter are insane and so consistent and so inimitable. And then the themes are often inventive and worthwhile. Like so often in a children's book, you get two of the three. You get beautiful illustrations and an interesting point, but the language is insipid, or you get rollicking language and an interesting point, but the thing is stupid to look at. Like, it's really hard to nail that trifecta. And Hunches and Bunches is one of my favorites because it's lesser known, and it's about that feeling of childhood boredom and not quite knowing what you want to do. It's essentially a children's book about malaise, and it's brilliant. So if you don't know that one, pick it up.
Julia, you're so right. All three elements. And then to do it over and over and over again, right? Iconically, Green Eggs and Ham, The Lorax, One Fish, Two Fish, Horton Hears a Who, Sneetches. Like, it's the consistency in addition to the singularity and eccentricity of the genius.
I love him being the Beyoncé of children's books. It's so
like,
true.
So crazy. It's so good. Okay, so this is up there with, like, I just discovered The Sky is Blue and the Beatles are, like, this really good band. You should check them out. But I finally belatedly saw the documentary Paris is Burning. And I saw it without, prior to even knowing that we were going to do the Beyoncé documentary, but they pair beautifully if you've never seen Paris is Burning. For those who don't know, it's a 1990 documentary about the ball scene, the drag ball scene in New York City over the course of the 80s. It took the filmmaker Jenny Livingston years to make it. I think she was Yale affiliated. I can't remember. She was very young. And it's just truly one of the greatest documentaries ever made. Absolutely pioneering for its totally sympathetic portrayal of the drag subculture of New York City. It brings you back to the city that those of us who knew it then remember. The 1980s, you know, you're sort of, it's an amazing decade in the history of the city because you're beyond the taxi driver apocalypse of the 70s, right? Ford to New York, drop dead. Ford to the city, drop dead. You're beyond that, right? You've walked away from the brink, but you aren't in the Giuliani city of the 90s, the Disneyfication, and then the, God, not to mention the fucking plutocratic sellout of what's-his-face Bloomberg. You know, you're in this kind of weird zone in between both cities where it's gritty and tough and the rents are still cheap and subcultures and bohemias can really still thrive. And this one was as autonomously self-generated as any subculture this country's ever seen. And in the face of so much hatred and AIDS. And AIDS not only destroying this community in some respects, though not totally. I mean, the resilience was incredible, but the hatred surrounding queer culture because of AIDS, it's just so powerfully moving, and it's a monument to the incorrigibility of the human personality and spontaneity of the human personality. And it, you could argue, it culminates, I mean, it has integrity totally all its own, and it didn't need mainstream culture or pop superstar divas to dignify it. But to the extent that Beyoncé is drawing upon that tradition in her work in an honorable way, it's amazing to go back and watch this movie and see it in its kind of original form. Anyway, Paris is Burning. What can I say? It's like one of the most moving things I've ever seen. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Really fun show.
Excellent.
I really enjoyed it. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Bertel. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.